Hello and welcome to ZEP Forward, a podcast celebrating individuals who are involved with projects that benefit Seton Hall University and the world around us. My name is Sarah Panectera, and I am proud to welcome and introduce our guest for today, Professor William J. Connell. Professor Connell is Seton Hall's La Motta Chair of Italian Studies and specializes in medieval and early modern intellectual history. He is the founding director of the Alberto Italian Studies Institute and has published widely and received many awards for his research, including a Fulbright and a Carnegie Fellowship, and as a member of the Institute for Advanced Study at Princeton. To start off, I'd like to give listeners a visual of what this volume looks like. It looks like an old light-colored book with a blank cover. It is bound in vellum or finely prepared animal skin, and the text inside is handwritten. This is not a published book. It is a handwritten copy of a text that was itself never published, as Professor Connell will discuss. There is no author, no title page. Deciphering what this text actually is required a reader not only with the skills to read the 16th century Italian script, but the broad familiarity with Italian history and literature of this period to be able to place this text in its historical context. Fortunately, it found this reader in Professor Connell. So without any further ado, Professor Connell, what is the significance of this book to the history of the church?
First of all, thank you, Sarah, for inviting me and for arranging this. Thank you, as director of Seton Hall's Special Collections, for having received this really valuable, exciting manuscript into Seton Hall's library. The most important thing is that this is the very first history of the church from the time of the apostles and Saint Peter, all the way through till the time of the writer in 1541, the first history of the church covering all that span that was written by a layman. Okay, all of the earlier histories of the church from the 300s on to the 1500s were written by priests. And this is the first history written by a layman. And I think it can be called quite legitimately the first modern history of the church. And in particular, then, for the Catholic Church, because it continues on through the separation of Roman Catholicism and Orthodox. It's also important because it includes it concludes with a radical proposal for the reform of the church. It's an internal reform that's proposed. Gianotti was a Catholic. The author Donato Gianotti, and I'll describe him soon, but he was a Catholic. He did not support and oppose the Lutheran Reformation, the Protestant break with the unity of the church, but he thought that the Roman Church needed to reform itself, and he proposed a more radical reform than was being proposed by others in the church at the time. He proposed that the church limit the powers of the papacy, that the pope should become a ceremonial figure. You might think of the role of the British monarch, for instance, that the powers of the church should be, which he thought were important and should be preserved, but they should be exercised by a virtuous college of cardinals who would function like a senate, passing measures by majority vote, debating measures openly, no secret ballots. And he wanted bishops to be elected locally by the clergy and people each diocese. It's a radical change, very utopian, very different from what the church would then adopt in its serious reform that took place at the Council of Trent from 1545 to 1563.
Wow. So how did you happen to find this book?
Oh, it's great. A friend likened it to an Indiana Jones story. Not really on that order, and none of the personal danger that that would exist. But really was by chance. I happened to be invited to Salerno on the coast of Italy, south of Naples, to present a book that I had published. And I noticed that there was a ferry that went up to the city of Amalfi, which is legendary, to the north of Salerno. And I'd always wanted to go to Amalfi. So I took the ferry, saw the cathedral, hiked above the town, had a wonderful lunch, and went back to the ferry landing and discovered that the ferry wouldn't be coming back until for another half hour. So I wandered into a shop, a kind of antique shop, the sort that they have for tourists in this sort in coastal towns like Amalfi. You know, there are pieces of porcelain, majolica, watercolors, old prints on the wall, things you can put in a suitcase and take home, essentially. And in the back, there were some old books, some of them leather-bound. And I wandered back there. I am something of a book hound and know a lot about manuscripts. And there I found, to my surprise, among these books, four manuscripts. That is, books that had been written by hand. Two of them from the 1500s, one from the 1600s, and one from the 1800s. I was amazed. I know something about what books cost. I asked the owner what they were and how much he wanted. He said that they had been purchased by his father, and he'd inherited the store. He would give them to me for 500 euros each. And I knew that that was a bargain, and so I bought them. And I bought them for the Seton Hall Library, which reimbursed me upon my return. And it was in studying these books that I found this particular is the most valuable of the very interesting four manuscript books. It's called Della Repubblica Ecclesiastica. That's Italian for On the Republic of the Church.
Wow. How do you think this manuscript ended up in that far-flung bookstore?
Yeah, well, certainly the father had purchased it almost certainly at auction, and there were stamps and book plates in the volumes. They all seem to come from what was the same collection by the late 1800s, early 1900s. All four books had belonged to the collection of a Florentine bookseller who had a shop on one of the main streets, and the shop closed in the 1980s. So that's how they got onto the private market. And before that, there were two book plates in two of them that I was able to trace to inventories of the Guadagni family of Florence, who had the largest private library in Florence in the 1700s. Which was a relief, actually, because one worries that books might have been stolen from churches or private library or public libraries rather, and these had always been owned publicly. Then, looking more closely, the manuscript said that it was written by M.D.G. Figured out with some research and having read the text carefully that MDG stood for Messer, a title that's sort of like Sir or Lord. We think of even the word Mister, Messer. So not the person's name, but then DG stood for Donato Gianotti, one of the leading humanists of 16th century Italy, who according to a letter published in the late 60s by a teacher of mine at the University of California. There's the mention of that he was writing a book on the Ecclesiastical Republic, on the Republic of the Church. And so that nailed down the author. And knowing that, even more exciting, in the Ambrosia Library of Milan, there are the notes of Mr. Gianotti's friend, Vincenzo Pinelli, that actually show him taking notes on the text. There are four pages of handwritten notes that summarize what he was finding and reading in these very books. So this manuscript that's now at Seton Hall almost certainly belonged to Gianvincenzo Pinelli, who was the most famous bibliophile in Italy in the late 1500s.
That is an incredible story of detective work. Wow. So while Gianotti was writing this, what was going on in the world? Can you describe some of the historical context that he was writing in?
Yeah. I mean, most importantly, the Lutheran Reformation began in 1517 when Martin Luther nailed his 95 theses against the doctrine of indulgences to the door of the chapel church in Wittenberg, Germany. In the next years, the controversy exploded, and by 1541, when Gianotti was writing, a good portion of Germany and also other parts of Europe, the Netherlands, France, had gone over to and Switzerland to different forms of Protestantism, challenging the idea of papal primacy, and reforming the Mass and how it was said, including giving communion in two kinds, that is with bread and with wine, and challenging various elements of what had become traditional doctrine within the church in over the course of the Middle Ages. So that's going on. And even as he was writing, there was a last attempt to get the theologians on both sides to agree at a famous colloquy in Ratisbon. There, to everyone's surprise, Melanchthon, who was the chief theologian of the Lutherans, and Johannes Eck and Gasparo Contarini on the side of the Catholics, agreed on the doctrine of justification by faith, which was considered to be the nut, the core of the theological controversy, whether a person is saved by receiving the gift of faith from God, or whether the works that a person does, of charity, of assisting neighbors, works to benefit the church, are also going to get you into heaven. They agreed that faith was needed, but once word got back to Rome and to Luther, both the Pope Paul III and Luther himself thought that this compromise was that, a surrender on principle. So the idea that there could be doctrinal reconciliation was really not. It seemed like it just wasn't going to happen. The push now began for reform of the administrative practices of the church, not the theological doctrine, but rather how the church is administered. Should the Pope have so much power? And it was recognized that there had been developed within the Roman Church practices concerning wealth, benefices, money paid by the faithful, and fees paid for indulgences, for taking over church benefices, things that really were identified and recognized even by those who were involved in them as practices that many called corrupt, and then many called simply not correct and needed to be correct. So that's going on. And then in addition, for Gianotti himself, who came from Florence, there's a question of global politics, of not church politics, but of secular politics, in that the power of the Habsburg monarch, Charles V, had expanded enormously. Think about this. Charles V, who was the ruler of, as young man, he first came to rule the Netherlands, inherits the kingdom of Spain from Ferdinand and Isabella. He is elected Holy Roman Emperor, meaning that he controlled Central Europe, Germany, but also the kingdom of Bohemia in modern-day Czechoslovakia, Hungary, really a remarkable expanse in Europe. And while Charles was ruler, Cortez conquered Mexico, Pizarro conquered Peru, and you have the first global empire under Charles V. In Italy, he controlled Milan. He took over the Duchy of Milan in northern Italy, and he was king of Sicily, king of Naples, and king of Sardinia. Donato Giannotti came from the Republic of and he had devoted his earlier career to preserving the independence of Florence under republican rule, not under the rule of a prince or a monarch. He was opposed to the Medici family, which had tried to rule Florence in that way. But he thought that a republic, that is, government by committees of qualified citizens who could bring different perspectives to important issues, could hold debates, who could learn from one another, was the best kind. And he thought that the church needed to take advantage of that rather than be under the control of a single ruler. And he pointed to a series of men who are sometimes called the bad popes, the worst popes. Alexander VI, the Borgia Pope, was poisoned, had many children, many mistresses even, and then Julius II, who donned armor to lead an army against the city of Bologna, Leo X, who allowed the Lutheran break to occur, who was also a luxurious man who preferred hunting to actually being in Rome and overseeing mass and liturgy, Clement VII, under whom the sack of Rome occurred in 57. So he thought that the papal monarchy was itself to blame for a lot of the problems. So in this world, afraid of Charles V, sadly disappointed by the popes, Giannotti saw the church as being the vehicle for retaining an independent state, a place of refuge for people afraid of the Habsburgs and Charles V, place for a republic to be restored.
Wow. So he's really bringing together these two worlds of the doctrinal debates that are happening and the political environment.
He sees them actually coming together. The doctrinal debates bother him. He writes in his history, it's a history of the Eastern Church as well as the West. He thinks that it was the doctrinal debates in the Eastern Roman Empire, the debates over Arianism versus Trinitarian Christianity, debates over the two natures of Christ as opposed to one nature, that these heresies and then the disputes, the factions, were to blame ultimately for the defeat of the Eastern Roman Empire and the take and the spread of Islam in the East, which he saw as as having a more unified message. He noted that the peoples that had been initially conquered by Islam and by Muslims converted willingly to Islam. So he saw this as actually a threat for Catholic Christians. But he saw it was the weakness of Christianity in the East that had permitted that to happen. So he wanted a strong Catholicism that would that would fend off the Turk, who was considered a major threat in the Italian peninsula and in Western Europe, 1500s.
So it sounds like he's really coming to this from the perspective of a loyalist. He thinks that this is going to make the church stronger and it's going to defend it from internal and external threats.
Yes, that's quite true. There was a slogan present in church in debates about the church from the 1300s called a reform in head and members, or reform in head and limb. That is with as being needed. Okay, the head being the papacy, but loyal Catholics subscribing to this, the need to yet the most important official reform plan drawn up under the instructions of Paul III involved changing the regulations for holding church offices, that you should not be able to be the priest or the holder of more than two or three benefices or churches, or dioceses or bishoprics, etc., that you should only have one, that you had to live in your diocese, okay? All good reforms. Gianotti liked these, but he thought they weren't reforms in head members. So the reform in the head would be reducing the Pope to a ceremonial role, putting the College of Cardinals at the head of the church, and then for the members to have the bishops elected locally by the clergy and people. Think of that. You know, there are people who would like that today.
It is quite radical, even though he's coming from this internal reform perspective. So you described how you discovered how Gianotti was the author of this text. Did he write this alone, or was it a collaborative process?
He wrote it at the invitation, at the request of his patron, Cardinal Niccolo Ridolfi, who was a Florentine like Gianotti himself. Gianotti had already written a book on Venice that he published at the request of Ridolfi. He had written a book on the Republic of Florence, dedicated to Cardinal. So he was living with Ridolfi. The two of them spent hours together. A friend describes they were like brothers together, Florentines. Both learned. Ridolfi was a very, very wealthy man with a very large library. He had poor eyesight, so probably Gianotti, my author, our author here, read to the cardinal. So he wrote this book at the request of the cardinal. The research was almost certainly, that is, he worked, and he was himself an excellent writer. But the ideas were almost certainly bounced off of and the book ends with this radical proposal. Ridolfi himself was a republican from Florence. He believed in Florentine republicanism, this is it's the ending of the book. The concluding chapter 18, urges Ridolfi himself as someone likely and eligible to become Pope, to initiate these reforms. Gianotti says that anyone who becomes Pope is almost immediately tempted by the immense power in his hands. But you, Cardinal, are a man of such virtue that you're the only one I can imagine surrendering your power in order to effect this reform. And later, this would become a possibility. Yeah. Let me tell the story, if I may. In 1550, the Pope Paul III died, and there was a conclave in Rome to choose the next pope. The conclave met in the Sistine Chapel. Mm-hmm. So imagine, give a sense of what this is like. The cardinals all had stalls with cots where they would sleep and eat. Ridolfi went to the conclave, and his conclavist, which would be to say his campaign manager, was none other than Donato Gianotti, his dear friend who was like a brother, the man who proposed turning the church into a republic. Also, it's important to realize this book was a secret between the two of them. Mm. No one else that we know had read it. So the proposal, this radical proposal, was not something that was known to the other cardinals in the conclave. Well, the first candidate, Cardinal Pole from England, who was favored to win because he had the support of Charles V, was one vote short of being elected when he declared, "On principle, I shall not vote for myself. God would have." Whereupon he began losing support, and he was not elected. And then a bunch of French cardinals arrived from France, and the French were opposed to the Emperor Charles V and opposed to Pole, and they liked Cardinal Ridolfi. And of all of the cardinals supported by the king, the one who was most acceptable to Emperor Charles V was none other than Niccolo Ridolfi. And so it looked like he would be elected. This Republican Pope would be there, although people didn't know that he was a Republican. When suddenly he fell ill.
Oh.
And he had to leave the Sistine Chapel began recovering. He was seen by excellent doctors in Rome. It was announced that he would return, whereupon the chairman, the man presiding at the conclave, said that when he came back, he would win by 2 votes. And suddenly he died.
Oh, no.
Before returning.
Oh, no.
So word went around, poison. All of the cardinals went on poison alert. Hmm. The conclavists and attendants were all told to leave, so just the cardinals themselves remained in the Sistine Chapel. And the best surgeon, best known surgeon available in Rome, who had performed many human dissections, was called in to perform an autopsy on Cardinal Ridolfi. And his written description exists, and it describes his liver as being black, and his bowels as having this putrid smell, and he declared with no uncertain terms that this was a poison. And so the cardinals, now without attendants, fearing poisoning, quickly resolved on a compromise candidate, Julius III. Who was not an especially effective pope. This chance of the church being reformed as a republic evaporated.
Oh, it was so close. I can't believe it. That's amazing. Really an act of fate there.
Yeah. The author went on. He was immediately hired by a French cardinal and went into the service of that cardinal, where he began persecuting Protestants in France. So he was pro-Catholic.
A happy ending for him too, I guess. So how do you think this work will change our understanding of Gianotti as a thinker?
Oh, it changes our thinking of Gianotti dramatically. Was known and has been known for hundreds of years as the writer of a book on Venice and as the writer of a book on Florence, since that book was published in the 1700s. Both of those republics were seen, the Florentine one was seen as failing because it was taken over by the Medici family and became a monarchy, that is a principate under the Grand Duke, Grand Ducal family of the Medici. And there were, for years, memories of the Republic as a great time, but Gianotti was imagined as being nostalgic for that old failed Republic. Venice was seen as exceptional. It's a maritime republic, difficult to conquer because it's out in the water, you know, and a commercial republic, and seen as again exceptional, not a model for a Europe that was now being taken over by this large monarchy. Think of Charles V, for instance, but also the France of Louis XIV is around the corner. Louis XIII under under Richelieu, and then Louis XIV under Mazarin. It's right around the corner. So that there's a move historically towards absolute monarchy. Okay, and Gianotti is seen as a man who was nostalgic for a lost past. Here, this book projects him right into the religious debates and controversies of the 16th century. And rather than a man who cared only about politics and was attached to a model of politics that was passé, we see him trying to engage a world that that Europe is fighting for tooth and nail in the whole 16th century. And his ideas for a reform of the church in head and members would have resonance at the Council of Trent, for instance. There was a heated discussion in the last session about the last seating of the council about the role of bishops, with plans drawn up specifically for the election of bishops in their own diocese rather than being appointed by a king or by Pope outside. He had ideas that that would have legs and but would not result in the reforms that he wished, but are still with us. Even today, we have what's called the Synodal Movement in Germany, which is trying to have bishops involve the laymen and the clergy of their diocese, establishing practices, doctrines, partial rebellion from or distancing from, let's say, the idea of absolute papal authority. So it makes Gianotti a more relevant, more exciting figure rather than one simply writing about a nostalgic past.
Wow. And on the broader view, how does it change our understanding of church history?
Yeah. It's... church history is, as I said, it was written by priests all the way down till the 1500s. Gianotti sees doctrine as being something that causes difficulty, division, disputes among learned men who have differing opinions, which are then voted on and decided by majority rule in the councils of the church, he says, rather than the councils establishing divine truth, is what the councils said themselves they were doing. So there's a kind of skeptical, distant approach towards the church. He accepts the councils as very important. It's just he doesn't see them as establishing divine truth. Instead, what they're doing is necessarily ending divisive disagreements. Which is also an important role for them. He's the first person in the writing of church history to seriously study the acts of the church council and to use a biographical source called the Liber Pontificalis, that is the Book of Popes, that had been written over the centuries with biographies of the popes, beginning with St. Peter on down to the 15th century. He compares the sources. He is not afraid to proclaim documents forged. And he's generally right in his approach. So there's a kind of skepticism, but in the interest of truth, not not in the interest of dogma or propaganda. So it's that's why I call this the first modern history of the church. Scientific approach, an interest on truth, comparing documents, looking for forgeries, being aware of them, is something that that the church historians still now value very, very highly, and Catholic historians as much as Protestant historians. It's the way history is done now, and he, I think, is the first to embark in on that model, to write the history of the church in that way.
It's exciting, like, to think about it in this time period, because it seems so radically new, even though this is the way the approach we sort of assume will be taken today. But the departure from one that just focuses on question of doctrine to one that brings in all of these sort of tools of scholarship now.
Right. Yeah. And so, considering that, then it remains interesting that the book never was published. It was only shown to a very few friends. And why? It's maybe not an accident that in 1542, the year after this was written, the Roman Inquisition was established under Paul III. And it would have become dangerous to advocate reducing the power of the papacy with a living pope in charge who wanted to have all of that authority. And so the book remained secret.
Wow.
And the Inquisition, of course, later in his life, Gianotti rewrote the book. He translated it into Latin. He took out things that he thought would be possibly offensive to the authorities. He did not advocate the turning of the church into a republic. He said that the popes at the end of the 16th century, he particularly liked Pius V, were doing a good job, and he dedicated the book to Pius V, and submitted it then to the Congregation of the Index, which worked together with the Inquisition to approve books. But even there, this revised book, now written in Latin, praising the popes, praising the papal monarchy, was rejected because there were too many passages that indicated times in the past when power of the papacy was limited, in which times when emperors had taken precedence over popes, the historical method was deemed too dangerous by the Congregation of the Index, which read the book in the 1570s.
Wow. It's sort of amazing, coming from our perspective, looking back on this from a perspective of centuries later, that things could have changed so radically within half of his lifetime, like 20, 30 years.
Yes. So I've done a lot of work on Machiavelli, and a letter that I published recently, written by a Florentine monk, describing Machiavelli and his relation to the church, tells a friend that, you know, Machiavelli lived in a different time. Things were freer. You could criticize and make jokes and make fun of church, priests, Dominicans, so forth. Mm-hmm. But in the 1570s, oh no.
Oh, wow. Wow. Well, this project seems like it has drawn on all of your skills of research and putting all these disparate pieces together. Can you talk a little bit about what has changed about your research since you started out in your career?
Oh, since I, well, when I began coming out of, I came out of the University of California, Berkeley, with a doctorate in Renaissance history. I was then very interested in social history, relations of patrons to clients, how political parties were formed, the role of wealth, of neighborhood, of marriages, and creating alliances, citizens. So really a social historian, but also interested in political thought. I would say that this project has taken me, although I've written about religious history and religious practices, this has taken me much deeper into questions of church, of ecclesiology, of how the church is organized and its history. It's also taken me back to lessons I learned at Berkeley with wonderful professors like Peter Brown and Stefan Kuttner and William Bousma and Randolph Starn, studying how the church evolved from the time of the Roman Empire and the first Christians down to the modern world. I think it's taken me deeper rather than in a completely new direction. But certainly my work now does address questions of piety, religious practice in a deeper way than started.
That's great. A message for our grad students here at Seton Hall, that those courses that you take as a graduate student can go with you throughout your career, continue to bear fruit. So what is your next project going to be about?
I have a small project of publishing an edition of Machiavelli's Prince in Italy for an Italian publisher. The book was written in Italian, but this would be with my introduction and commentary. There's more work to be done on Donato Gianotti. I'm now organizing an international conference at the University of Lyon about Gianotti, with the goal really of presenting this text to the world. There are other projects, but it becomes utopian to start to rattle them off. We'll see what I can get done in the next year.
Well, I'm excited that there'll be a conference that people will really be able to dig into this.
Thank you, Sarah.
So where can we find this book?
Well, it's in special collections. There's collections that you yourself direct. I've published now, and this is for me also very exciting, in May of this year, 2023, the leading academic publisher in Italy, called Giulio Einaudi in Turin, published this book in a very prestigious series of crucial texts of Italian literature and philosophy and religion. It's at a good price, beautifully built and nicely bound, with a rich commentary and a long introduction by yours truly. I did a book tour in June with presentations in Turin, in Florence, and in Rome that were well attended and very exciting. The book can be purchased from Amazon.it. and also the Einaudi website. If you Google under my name or Gianotti, you'd be able to find it.
All right, wonderful. And you're giving a talk on October 30th.
On October 30th here at Seton Hall University, we'll have a presentation. I'll speak on the discovery of the manuscript and repeat some of the things I've said in this podcast, I think. But our idea also, because I'll be speaking together with Monsignor Thomas Guarino of our school of our seminary and a professor of theology, about efforts for reform in the 20th and 21st century, beginning especially with Vatican II, but continuing through to discussions now about the role of bishops and synods in contemporary Catholicism. And so that's, again, to get back to your question about how this changes our view of Gianotti. It makes him someone who's relevant in a contemporary way that is wonderful for someone who wrote in 1541.
Fantastic. And that is in Bethany Hall A at 6 p.m. So thank you, Professor Connell, for joining us today. And thanks to our listeners for joining us at Zet Forward. Please join us next time when we talk to someone else from the Seton Hall community about their work and how it benefits the world around us. Until we meet again, all the best.